This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
We are a boutique law firm with 11 lawyers and 3 staff, and we specialize exclusively in helping whistleblowers under the various and increasing number of U.S. whistleblower reward programs.
That was Mary Inman. This is Tom Fox. Welcome you to the award-winning FCPA Compliance Report. Today, Mary Inman comes back to join me to discuss what we know about the DOJ Whistleblower Initiative, and more importantly, where it might be headed. Every compliance officer will need to be aware of this program because it will put additional pressure on you to investigate, to have a culture of speak up, and frankly, to get it right. I know you'll enjoy this episode. First, a word from this month's sponsor, Ethico.
Imagine a workspace where efficiency and compliance coexist harmoniously. Don't just dream of faster resolutions, make it your reality. Visit ethico.com/CPN today to book a demo and dive into our exclusive white paper by Tom Fox, The ROI of Compliance, and to try our free ROI calculator. Empower your team with the tools they deserve.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox back again for another episode. Absolutely thrilled to have Whistleblower Partner LLP. Yes, you heard that right. Mary Inman back. Mary, first of all, welcome back, and also congrats on forming your new firm.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you so much. It's exciting times.
Mary, for those who may not know about your new firm, why don't you start this podcast by telling us a little bit about Whistleblower Partners LLP?
Well, I would love to. Thank you so much. We are a boutique law firm with 11 lawyers and 3 staff, and we specialize exclusively in helping whistleblowers under the various and increasing number of U.S. whistleblower reward programs. So we may sound like a new firm, but we have over 100 years of combined experience. So a lot of us, like myself, have been doing this for close to 30 years. We do have some newer partners who are a little bit newer to the practice area, newer in the form of like 5 to 9 years. So it's a really exciting time for us to be able to focus exclusively in this area because it's an ever-increasing area, as we're about to talk about, that we're used to the SEC and the IRS and CFTC having whistleblower programs, and now it looks like DOJ is well on its way to a TIP program. It's an increasing area and an exciting area for us to continue to plant our flag in the ground.
Mary, in terms of the expertise in your firm, we've had the privilege of having you on this podcast for several episodes over the past couple of years. Could you tell us some of your founding partners and their expertise and how it might be a little different than yours?
Yes, we are a very diverse group in terms of our expertise. We really span every one of the programs. So one of our partners who I've been practicing with for close to 30 years is Eric Havian, and he covers a lot of the programs, but he's probably best known as being one of the singularly most successful attorneys in the False Claims Act, specifically under the defense contractor space. So he actually just settled one of the first and certainly the largest Iraq war cases against KBR, a case that was about $100 million for basically over-ordering of parts that they shouldn't have. They should have cross-leveled when they needed new parts. They should have drawn from different warehouses throughout the sphere of war. So he's one of our founders. He also does SEC and other things, but he really is one of the definitive defense contractor cases specialists. And then you have my partner, Poppy Alexander, who is really on the front end of the spear for the new FinCEN program. The FinCEN whistleblower program involves both violations of the U.S. Bank Secrecy Act, so one of the country's statutes best known to protect against anti-money laundering. But more recently, the FinCEN program has been expanded to include violations of U.S. sanctions law. So she is one of our experts there. And then my partner, Ari Yampolsky, is fantastic, does a lot of healthcare, but also works a lot with me on actually False Claims Act cases involving customs fraud, which is also another area in the False Claims Act. I think people are used to False Claims Act cases involving defense contractors or Medicare fraud. Another big area, especially with the China tariffs, where a lot of people are not paying, a lot of people importing goods into the U.S. are not paying their China tariffs. And so that's been a big area for us. So those are just a few. I could keep going, but those are just a few of my other partners.
Mary, you've mentioned a couple of times about the Department of Justice, and we finally got a little bit of clarity from the DOJ announcing a pilot program. We had you as a guest on the Everything Compliance podcast several weeks back, where you talked about what some of the hopes you had for the new DOJ program. So could I maybe start with asking, do you think the DOJ met what you would have considered a good whistleblower or financial incentive program from the government's perspective?
Yeah, so the pilot program has come by many different names. A lot of people are calling it the DOJ White Collar Whistleblower Program. And I feel like they're off to a good start. They announced this program in San Francisco, actually, at one of the big ABA's White Collar Crime conferences. And they said at that time they're doing a 90-day sprint. So that was March 7th. So we're almost halfway into that 90-day sprint. And the sprint was to really put some meat on the bones of what this program is going to look like. So I think in the broad strokes that they painted about what the program is going to be, I largely agree. But there are some areas where I disagree. But I want to focus on where I think they've got it right, because to the largest extent, they're right where they need to be, which is that there are areas, now that there are so many different whistleblower reward programs across multiple agencies, there's actually times when whistleblowers' tips fall between the gaps. So what this program seeks to do, among many different things, but one of the biggest things it seeks to do is address a gap that exists under the SEC program. And it's a topic that you, Tom, talk a lot about, which is under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Under the SEC program, whistleblowers can bring tips about FCPA violations if they are relating to public issuers, so companies that are listed on one of our stock exchanges. If they are not, SEC does not have jurisdiction, and those whistleblowers, and I've had many who have had to turn away, have nowhere to go. Meaning they could certainly try and bring a tip, but they're not going to get the financial protections that a whistleblower office provides. And also, it's not just the financial protections. It's having an office of the whistleblower that's staffed up and trained to receive these tips and act on them and move on them quickly. So this is one of the holes that the DOJ program seeks to fill, is that if you have FCPA, information about FCPA violations about a company that's not publicly listed or listed and not on a U.S. exchange, but maybe the London Stock Exchange or the Toronto Stock Exchange. Those are areas that are still of interest to DOJ. So that was one of the main areas that they were looking to fill. The other piece, sticking with corruption, is they also wanted to get at domestic corruption, right? We have incentives to go for Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations, but what about bribery of our own government officials? And you look at, not to pick on any particular senator, but we do have Bob Menendez having some issues, right, with corruption, alleged corruption. And so I think there's a lot going on there that it makes sense that we would want to clean our own houses too, and not just clean the houses of going on in other countries as well. So those are just two of the areas, but it's really directed at serious financial crimes, which I think is an important area for DOJ to focus on.
Well, Mary, that's really one of the things that strikes me, which is so important about this DOJ initiative. You and I have talked about FCPA, bribery and corruption, but it's much broader than that. And I think we are going to see a lot of what's traditionally been criminalized activity brought to the DOJ now that there's a financial incentive program to do so. And frankly, I think FCPA may be a very small part of that, given the other financial crimes that go on that sort of falls out of the categories of a false claims tax or an SEC or an CFTC or any of the other alphabet agencies. Mary, did you see anything, at least at this preliminary stage, which would indicate to you the process by which a whistleblower or a whistleblower represented by counsel would approach the DOJ? So in contrast, in the FCPA, I talked to Mike Volkoff or other practitioners, say we just call up the FCPA unit and said we'd like to schedule time to come in and self-disclose. I assume it'll be more formal than that, but perhaps not.
Yeah, so my sense is that this 90-day sprint, one of the things that DOJ is going to be doing is doing what we've seen other agencies that are new to create whistleblower offices do, is go and talk to these sister agencies and ask how they've done it. So my sense is right now DOJ is talking to the folks at the SEC, the IRS, who've actually created offices of the whistleblowers and having a central clearinghouse to take the information. So right now, if I wanted to file a tip with DOJ, I don't have a place to do it. I have to call and try and figure out if I'm going to get to the right person. By the end of this 90-day sprint, I'm confident you're going to see the creation of an office of the whistleblower, so that it'll just be like the SEC or the IRS or the CFTC, that you will have a central repository and that it'll be staffed by someone who is the chief or the head of that office, and that those people will, in essence, be the clearinghouses, the filter to decide, will these tips, do they rise to a sufficient level to get passed across the threshold over to the enforcement divisions? I think they will be the gatekeepers, and I think it's appropriate. It's certainly been, it's worked really well in the SEC context that you know who you report to, and they actually have a portal where you can upload your tip and your documents. So I predict that's what we're going to see, but right now we don't know. The other thing we don't know, which was really difficult for a whistleblower, for many of my whistleblower clients, is we don't know if they're going to allow you to report anonymously. All of the programs that I know from the various agencies allow confidential reporting, but not all agencies allow anonymous reporting. And that can be really important, particularly when we're looking at a lot of financial crimes. For instance, if you've got a financial crime that involves a Russian oligarch or other players, where if you're bringing information about folks like that, your personal safety can be at risk. So it can be really important that you be allowed to be anonymous. Obviously, if you're going to be an anonymous whistleblower, you have to be represented by counsel, because they have to have somebody in DOJ that can obviously serve as the intermediary and representative. But in most cases, I predict they will also be like the SEC or CFTC and allow people to file tips generally without counsel. So we are hoping that that's what they're going to do, but we don't know yet. We're still waiting as they kind of go out and DOJ does their intelligence gathering. Remember, one of the strange things, right, is that DOJ doesn't have to go external to get intelligence on how to have a good whistleblower program. DOJ is the home of the False Claims Act, and in DOJ's affirmative civil enforcement section lives some people with probably the largest depth of experience since the False Claims Act really was reinvigorated in 1980s. It's a similar program, but different. So they really don't have all the in-house experience to draw on. They'll draw on some, but remember the False Claims Act, the whistleblower themselves are parties to the litigation. They file a complaint in the name of the government, and they're really deputized as private attorney generals. And that is not the case with tips. So it really is the first time DOJ will be using a whistleblower tip program, but it's not the first time they've learned how to deal with whistleblowers. So I'm hoping they'll draw on some of their intelligence, their homegrown intelligence, as well as going outside to the various agencies.
Mary, I think probably the first podcast I ever had with you, we talked about the rich tradition of whistleblowers in the United States. And as I recall, the United States was one of the very first Western companies that formalized whistleblowing as a legal remedy for the government in what we used to call, maybe we still call it, QI-TAM cases. And so with that sort of rich background, and you mentioned the False Claims Act being reinvigorated, the patron of that, Senator Charles Grassley, how do you think he views this initiative by the Department of Justice? Is he just a fighter against fraud, waste, and abuse and wanting to bring transparency? Is or is it, am I off the mark?
I love this question because I love to channel Chuck Grassley whenever I can as sort of the godfather of all whistleblower programs. He must be very excited about this program. That's my prediction. I have not spoken to him personally. But the reason is he was one of the original, back in 1986, proponents of reinvigorating the False Claims Act. And he's really, I think, one of, among his long legacy of accomplishments, I think he will regularly say his being an advocate and champion for whistleblowers and the proponent of these whistleblower laws is, I think, his proudest achievement. So what's important is that, so he was there and did a bipartisan effort to get the False Claims Act amended in 1986, and it really has taken off since then. But one of the first things he did after that is he pushed for and successfully got the introduction of the IRS whistleblower program. And so the way the False Claims Act was written, it said, we want whistleblowers to bring information about all misappropriation of government funds except tax. And I think they felt like that was too squirrely because I think there was a worry that everybody, every ex-wife and ex-husband will be bringing whistleblower suits against each other for tax evasion. And so it sort of remained a carve out until early 2000s when Chuck Grassley really pushed for it and got it adopted. So I say that because that history, because I think that is just indicative of he has always wanted to push forward these programs, and he sees the way that has continued to succeed. So I can't see why he wouldn't want a gap-filling program. And I think he'd almost feel like his legacy is actually reaching its logical conclusion when DOJ, which started these kinds of whistleblower cases under the False Claims Act, is now circling back and adopting what all these agencies have done, which is this type of tip program. So I think he would be chuffed, as they love to say in England. I think he'd be well chuffed by this, but far be it for me to put words in his mouth.
Mary, we've had a lot, perhaps a lot, but not enough discussion about mental health issues for whistleblowers. And you were very articulate on the Everything Compliance podcast about raising that issue. I wanted to use that as the way to introduce the topic of protection for whistleblowers. Obviously, under Sarbanes-Oxley, we had the beginnings of protection for those who blew the whistle, and then that expanded under Dodd-Frank. Do you see or anticipate any protection for whistleblowers under this new DOJ program, or is that something that is required via legislation from Congress?
I have a sense that we'd have to get congressional approval for this. And there are a lot of us are actually looking at this issue because, again, it is another place where the evolution of our definition of what constitutes a protection that a whistleblower needs has grown and evolved over time. And it's grown and evolved in a good way. So it started with just anti-retaliation protection. So if you spoke up and your employer fired you, obviously there should be a cause of action for you as an individual employee. And then we reached this new idea that actually financial protections, just because it can be really hard to prove retaliation and the statistics are pretty grim and the likelihood a whistleblower is going to succeed in an anti-retaliation case, because often the burden is on the whistleblower to prove that they were fired for this reason and not for some pretextual reason that an employer may try and create after the fact. So these financial incentives that whistleblowers get for bringing actionable information to agencies actually is something that provides a real financial protection. And I think that the next stage in our evolution is to have some sort of funding that is ultimately a whistleblower protection fund that, again, puts some financial protections under whistleblowers while they wait for these rewards. And then remember, not all whistleblowers are eligible under a reward program. So I think there's a lot of us who feel like Senator Grassley and then Senator Bernie Sanders may be two logical bedfellows to sort of approach for something resembling a protection fund that would deal with whistleblower wellness, because there's just been far too many suicides and far too many really negative health repercussions to whistleblowers. And I think we would really be well suited to do that. Ironically, Ukraine is the first country I'm aware of that actually has this kind of a protection in place now. it's not surprising that they now have robust whistleblower programs. There's so much foreign money flowing through the country. They want to make sure that they're proving that they're good stewards of all the aid money. So they've really made whistleblower and whistleblower protection a linchpin. And so they literally have a whistleblower protection fund that I'm keen to look at and borrow from and bring back to our Congress to say, if Ukraine's doing it, we should be doing it too. Not normally the way things work, but I do feel like that is the next sort of vanguard in our fight to support whistleblowers. Because remember, whistleblowers are often our first and last line of defense against many of some of the biggest fraud and corruption scandals that would otherwise go unnoticed. So I think it really behooves us to make sure we continue to support them. And sadly, the Boeing whistleblower suicide is just one really more recent example. There's been lots of history of this happening in terms of the sort of character assassination and mistreatment of whistleblowers.
Barry, starting with the QI-TAM laws from the U.S. Civil War up through the False Claims Act, where the import of those laws is to not make money for whistleblowers. It's to reimburse the government for fraud, waste, and abuse and being overcharged or not getting a fair service or product for the government spend. Under the SEC whistleblowers, it's to actually protect shareholders who have been defrauded in accounting cases. Do you see this DOJ initiative as really not simply criminalizing or bringing criminal tips to the DOJ, but protecting corporations that don't have these other protections?
Yes, right. You can see that a lot of these corporate crimes that go unaddressed are also have a really negative effect on competitors, right? So you are protecting sort of the companies that are not, that are actually behaving legally, and are, you're making it more likely that companies that are getting a competitive advantage illegally by engaging in some sort of a financial fraud are going to be held to account. So I do think that there is, in one way, the ability that this program is going to get some sort of relief for corporate good actors. But I think your question was also directed at, like, does it help companies themselves that now that insiders are going to be more likely to come forward? I think it does. Because my experience has been, and you can actually design a whistleblower program to encourage people to report internally first. And so certainly with the SEC program, whistleblowers who've reported internally first are likely to, it will be considered a plus factor in that range of 10 to 30% on what you should receive. So you can design it in a way to allow whistleblowers to sort of be more inclined to speak up internally before they go external, which I think in a way, if we have enlightened companies, they are more likely to listen to those whistleblowers, hopefully, and change their behavior before that whistleblower is ignored and has to go to the regulator. In the first instance, our clients almost always choose to try and talk and have it addressed at the company level first. And there's some data that backs this, like 83% of the whistleblowers who received rewards from the SEC in the past few years have reported internally first, but were ignored. So I think anything we can do to get companies to listen up and to make it more likely that these people will speak up will certainly redound to the benefit of the companies. They don't always see it that way. That's the problem. We need to really much, very much change the culture around whistleblowing, that not only are whistleblowers not disloyal, in fact, they're some of your most loyal employees because they're telling you the inconvenient, hard truths that maybe some of your other employees who'd rather sort of just keep their heads below the parapet don't want to tell you.
I don't know if we've done too many podcasts together or your last answer portends we're going to start a series, because I didn't ask you that question, but I was going to. That's the first time anyone's ever asked a question I was thinking about asking. So kudos. And that was really what I wanted to end with, is if a board of directors came to you and said, Mary Inman, you're a founding partner, Whistleblower Partners LLP, We have seen the results of what you and your colleagues have done at Constantine over the years before you formed your new firm. We want to incorporate the lessons that you have learned into protections for our company. And I don't know if anyone's ever asked you that, but if they did, how would you counsel a board?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think I would have a number of pieces of advice. And some of them are very obvious and some of them maybe not so obvious. If you want to encourage whistleblowing inside your company and you mean it, then it's really important to have that be part of your performance evaluations. Like employees look at those sorts of things and measure them. They say, well, this is what I'm being measured against. So you should have, and it should be a plus factor in a performance evaluation if someone is someone who has basically served a risk function or has brought attention to an issue that has helped protect the company. I think it's a really important way that you can kind of start to signal on a basic level these sorts of things. I also think you need to do really robust exit interviews, because what I have understood is that from a lot of data and studies is that women and people of color are much more likely to leave an organization than to speak up. So I think you need to be gathering that data to know what you're missing, because I think you're going to be blind if you don't, and to do it in a way where you actually really get a robust answer. But I think most importantly, it was funny. I was just in Frankfurt at a panel at the International Bar Association, and I was shocked that it was the idea for the panel came from one of the organizers that should companies be paying rewards themselves to whistleblowers who speak internally? And I certainly think that is something that folks can consider. I mean, I don't know that you necessarily have to reward them in the same way that like the SEC does, but I do think it's very important the way you virtue signal. If we call out someone for speaking out and doing the right thing and showing that not only did they not have the traditional tactic taken where we shoot the messenger and they've been fired or put in the equivalent of Siberia, corporate Siberia, you actually temper that by showing not only do we want to showcase this person, this is something laudable and we gave them a bonus this year because of it. I think those are the sorts of things you really need to do when you're signaling that you actually are the kind of organization that does more than just pay lip service and says, oh, we have these internal reporting hotlines and we want them to use them. Because I think the sad reality is most people feel like we won't be heard if we use those channels. And not only if we use them, we won't be protected. And so I think the more you can change that and make it clear that we're not that organization, we actually mean what we say, then you're going to increase the number of tips that you get. And actually some data that I've frequently talked to you about that comes out of GWU and the University of Utah actually says that companies that have active speak-up cultures are actually more profitable, because they can address those problems that the canaries in the coal mine, who are the whistleblowers, address to them before they sort of metastasize into something much bigger.
Mary, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this episode, but if our listeners wanted to either connect with you or find out more about Whistleblower Partners LLP, what would be the best place for them to go or a way for them to do?
Yeah, so we're on LinkedIn. We have a company page there, and then I'm on LinkedIn as well. You can also find us from our bio pages on our website. All of us, it's our email addresses are just our first names, and then at whistleblower.law.
Well, Mary, I wanted to thank you again for taking the time to visit with me. Congratulations again. It's a really big deal. I've been a part of those efforts from time to time in my legal career, and I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Likewise, thanks so much for having me on, Tom. Always happy to join you.
This is Tom Fox again. As I mentioned at the start of this episode, our network sponsor for this month is Ethoco. I have partnered with Ethoco to help you figure out the ROI of your compliance program. I've written a white paper on that that's available at the website listed in the show notes. And Ethoco has developed an ROI calculator to help you determine the ROI of your compliance program. I hope you will check out both of these items this month. This is Tom Fox again. We've linked to the article that we referenced in this podcast in the show notes, so check it out, as well as an additional article by my podcast guest. The FCPA Compliance Report is a special production of the Compliance Podcast Network.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.